A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to talk about Japanese game shows, starting with Takeshi's Castle, and then branching out into other absurd shows that have crossed over into the wider Japanophile world. And look, I have to say up front, I have spent an embarrassing number of hours watching people fall into mud.
You and half the planet. Takeshi's Castle is one of those cultural artifacts that just exists outside normal television logic. It originally aired on TBS in Japan from 1986 to 1990, then had a revival in the early 2000s. The premise is beautifully simple. Somewhere between 100 and 140 contestants attempt to storm a castle controlled by Count Takeshi, that's Takeshi Kitano, the legendary filmmaker and comedian, and his guards. To get there, they have to survive a gauntlet of physical challenges that are basically designed to humiliate them.
The humiliation is the point. That's what's interesting. It's not really a competition show. It's a comedy show disguised as a competition show.
And you can see Kitano's fingerprints all over it. This is the same man who directed Fireworks and Sonatine, deeply contemplative, often violent art films, and he's standing there in a castle shouting at people as they get knocked into a pool of water by a giant foam boulder. The show was originally called Fuen, Takeshi-jo, which roughly translates to Turbulence, Takeshi's Castle. And the format was essentially a series of elimination challenges, followed by a final showdown where the survivors would storm the castle itself.
Let's describe some of the actual challenges for people who haven't seen it, because the descriptions alone are worth the price of admission.
So you've got skipping stones, where contestants try to cross a pond by jumping on stones that are secretly designed to sink. You've got knock-knock, where people run through a maze of paper doors, and some of them are real walls. You've got the infamous bridge ball, where contestants try to cross a narrow bridge while a giant swinging ball tries to knock them into the water below. And then there's Honeycomb Maze, a giant labyrinth with paper walls where contestants get hopelessly lost while guards chase them.
The Honeycomb Maze is basically a metaphor for life. You're running, you think you know where you're going, and then you hit a paper wall and a man in a costume tackles you.
The thing is, the guards in Takeshi's castle had this incredible aesthetic. They wore these dark outfits with sunglasses, and they were just relentlessly committed to the bit. They would chase contestants with such seriousness. The contrast between their deadpan intensity and the absolute chaos around them is pure comedy.
There's a specific energy to Japanese variety television that doesn't really exist anywhere else. It's not just that the challenges are absurd, it's that everyone involved treats the absurdity with complete sincerity.
That sincerity is the key. If the contestants were winking at the camera the whole time, it wouldn't work. But they genuinely try. They believe they might win. And then they get absolutely obliterated by a rolling log, and it's devastating and hilarious in equal measure.
The international version is a whole other layer of this story. Most people outside Japan didn't see the original broadcasts. What they saw was the version that got packaged for international markets, and particularly, the version that got a comedy dub.
So Takeshi's Castle was licensed internationally under the title Takeshi's Castle, but in the UK it aired on Challenge TV with voiceover commentary by Craig Charles from Red Dwarf, and his commentary turned it into something entirely different. He wasn't just translating or explaining, he was doing a running comedy routine over the footage. And that dubbed version is what most people in the English-speaking world think of when they think of Takeshi's Castle.
It's a fascinating case study in how localization can fundamentally alter a show's identity. The original Japanese version had its own comedic sensibility. Takeshi Kitano himself was a major part of the humor. But the Craig Charles version layered on this very British, very sarcastic, almost sports commentary energy.
I'd argue it improved it. Not in the sense of being better than the original, but in the sense of creating something that was its own distinct work of comedy. The Charles commentary was so good that it became the definitive version for an entire generation. People quote it. People remember his reactions as much as they remember the actual stunts.
Andy's down. That's going to hurt in the morning.
The show had this incredible staying power. It aired originally in the 80s, the revival was in the 2000s, and then there was a 2023 reboot on Amazon Prime Video with a new set of hosts and challenges. The format just refuses to die because the core idea is timeless. Put people in absurd physical situations and film what happens.
What's the success rate, actually? How many people ever actually won?
I looked this up. In the original run, across 133 episodes, the castle was successfully stormed only a handful of times. I think the exact number is something like 8 or 9 total victories, and the prize for winning was 1 million yen, which at the time was about $4,000. So you're getting pummeled by giant foam boulders for a 1 in 1,000 shot at a fairly modest cash prize.
Which makes it even funnier. The stakes are simultaneously enormous and completely trivial.
That's actually an important distinction between Takeshi's Castle and some of the other shows we're going to talk about. Takeshi's Castle was, at its core, a game show with a prize. Other absurd Japanese shows are pure variety comedy with no competitive element at all. So let's talk about Gaki no Tsukai.
This is the one I was hoping you'd bring up.
Gaki no Tsukai ya Arahende, which translates roughly to "This is no job for kids," is a variety show that's been running since 1989. It stars the comedy duo Downtown. That's Masatoshi Hamada and Hitoshi Matsumoto, along with other regular cast members like Hose Yamasaki, Naoki Tanaka, and Shuzu Endo. And their most famous recurring segment is the Batsu Game, which translates to Punishment Game.
Describe the Batsu Game premise, because it's one of the most beautifully simple comedic concepts ever devised.
The Batsu Games are annual New Year specials that run for hours. The premise, the cast members participate in some kind of challenge or bet, and the losers have to endure a punishment. The punishment is that they're locked in a room, or a series of rooms, for 24 hours, and every time they laugh, they get whacked on the backside with a bamboo stick or some other implement. Meanwhile, the producers subject them to increasingly absurd scenarios designed specifically to make them crack.
The scenarios are unhinged. There's one where they have to sit through a fake educational lecture, and the lecturer keeps doing increasingly bizarre things with his pointer and his slides. There's another where they're in a fake hotel, and the staff keep delivering room service items that make no sense. The cast is trying desperately not to laugh, and the audience is watching them physically suffer from the effort of suppressing it.
The physical toll is real. Hamada once described the experience as painful. Not just the whacking, but the muscular strain of suppressing laughter for hours. These are professional comedians who laugh for a living, and they're being forced to remain stone-faced while their colleagues and production team do everything possible to break them. It's psychological warfare disguised as comedy.
What makes it work is that these people have been working together for decades. They know each other's weaknesses. They know exactly what will make each other laugh. So when NDO gets targeted with something specific to his personality or his history, the audience understands the layers.
Endo is particularly famous for being the most easily broken. He's known for having a very expressive face and very little ability to control it. The Batsu Games would often build entire segments around making Endo laugh specifically, and he would fail almost immediately. It became a running joke that Endo was basically guaranteed to get punished.
The other show that has to be mentioned here is Sasuke, or as it's known internationally, Ninja Warrior.
This is a perfect counterpoint to Takeshi's Castle, because Sasuke is serious. It's an obstacle course competition that started in 1997 and has become a global phenomenon. The American version, American Ninja Warrior, has been running since 2009 and is still going strong. But the original Japanese version has this almost reverential tone that the international versions sometimes lose.
The obstacles in Sasuke are dangerous. These aren't foam boulders. People are falling from significant heights into water. They're doing upper body challenges that require elite-level athleticism, and the failure rate is astronomical.
The course has 4 stages. Stage 1 is a timed obstacle course. Stage 2 is speed-focused. Stage 3 is upper body endurance. No time limit, just pure strength. And stage 4 is a rope climb up a tower with a time limit that gets tighter every tournament. The total victory rate is even lower than Takeshi's Castle. Across 40 tournaments, only 6 people have ever achieved total victory.
One of them, Makoto Nagano, became a national hero. He was a fisherman who trained on his boat and became the face of the show.
Nagano is the perfect Sasuke story. He competed in 26 tournaments. He achieved total victory once in the 17th tournament. He was a commercial fisherman who built his own training equipment on his boat, and his dedication was so pure that he became the embodiment of what the show was about. When he finally won, it was emotional. And then he kept coming back, tournament after tournament, even as he aged, even as new obstacles were added. He retired in 2017 at age 44.
There's something deeply Japanese about that. The dedication to a single pursuit over decades. The acceptance of repeated failure. The refusal to quit. It's the opposite of the instant gratification competition shows we see in the West.
The show treats failure with respect. When a competitor falls, the announcers don't mock them. They acknowledge the effort. There's a dignity to it. The music swells, and you get a slow-motion replay of the moment they lost their grip, and it's treated almost like a sports documentary rather than a comedy.
Which brings us to the show that's the exact opposite of that, MXC.
Most Extreme Elimination Challenge. This is where we need to talk about the American localization that makes the Craig Charles Takeshi's Castle look like a straight translation.
MXC took footage from a Japanese show called Takeshi's Castle. Wait, no, different show. It took footage from Kinniku Banzuke, which was a physical competition show, and also from another show called Viking, the ultimate obstacle course. And then they completely rewrote the audio. New dialogue, new commentary, new premise, new everything.
Kinniku Banzuke, which translates to muscle ranking, was a legitimate athletic competition show that aired from 1995 to 2002. It featured ordinary people attempting feats of strength and endurance. There was a segment called The Gauntlet, where contestants had to run through an obstacle course. The original Japanese version treated this with complete sincerity. The American version, MXC, turned it into something that barely resembles the source material.
The MXC commentary team, Vic Romano and Kenny Blankenship, treated the footage like a deranged sports broadcast. They gave the contestants absurd names. They invented backstories. They turned physical challenges into elaborate, nonsensical narratives. And the result was one of the funniest things ever to air on American television.
Right you are, Ken. That was Vic's catchphrase. And the show had this complete commitment to its own absurdity. The field was called the world's toughest competition in town. Every episode had a fake sponsorship segment. The contestants were given names like Guy LaDouche and Baba Booey. And the physical challenges, which were difficult, were narrated as if they were life-or-death struggles.
Here's the thing. MXC is arguably a more radical localization than the Craig Charles Takeshi's Castle, because it didn't just add commentary. It fundamentally rewrote what the show was about. The original Kinniku Banzuke was about celebrating human achievement. MXC was about mocking human failure. They took the same footage and told a completely different story.
There's an ethical question there that I think is worth examining. The people in the footage, the actual Japanese contestants, were participating in a serious athletic competition. They trained for it. They took it seriously. And then their footage got repurposed into a comedy show where they were the butt of the joke, without their knowledge or consent. I'm not saying MXC shouldn't exist. I laughed as hard as anyone, but there's something slightly uncomfortable about it.
The friction between those two readings is part of what makes the localization history of Japanese television so interesting. You have the original intent, you have the localization intent, and you have the audience's experience, and those three things don't always line up neatly.
Let's talk about another show that crossed over, Iron Chef. The original Japanese version, Ryori no Tetsujin, which aired from 1993 to 1999. This show is fascinating because it took the format of a cooking competition and elevated it to something approaching opera.
The chairman, the dramatic ingredient reveal, the over-the-top commentary, Iron Chef treated cooking the way sports broadcasts treat championship games.
The production values were extraordinary for a cooking show. They built a full kitchen stadium. The chairman, Takeshi Kaga, would appear in these elaborate costumes and bite into a yellow bell pepper to start each battle. The commentary was delivered with the gravity of a war correspondent. And the Iron Chefs themselves, Chen Kenichi, Hiroyuki Sakai, Masahiko Kobe, became genuine celebrities.
The dubbed English version, which aired on Food Network in the late 90s and early 2000s, kept the original tone but added voice actors who leaned into the theatricality. The result was a show that was simultaneously a serious cooking competition and a completely absurd spectacle.
It introduced Western audiences to ingredients and techniques they'd never seen before. The original Iron Chef is directly responsible for the popularization of Japanese cuisine in America in the early 2000s. Before Iron Chef, most Americans thought Japanese food was basically sushi and teriyaki. After Iron Chef, they knew about uni and Kobe beef and 100 other things.
The chairman's nephew, by the way, took over the franchise and created the American version, Iron Chef America, which ran for years. But the original has a weirdness that the American version never quite captured.
Because the American version was too polished. It was too professional. The original Iron Chef had this slightly unhinged quality. The chairman's capes, the dramatic lighting, the way the announcers would describe a simple stir-fry as if it were a military campaign. It was cookiness theater, and the American version was cookiness sports.
Another show that deserves mention is Zagamen, The Endurance. This one is less well-known internationally, but is one of the most absurd concepts in television history.
Zagamen was a segment on a variety show where contestants were subjected to various forms of discomfort and had to endure without reacting. The premise sounds simple, but the execution was absolutely deranged. Contestants would have their legs waxed while trying to deliver a speech. They'd sit in ice baths while being tickled. They'd have to maintain a straight face while a comedian screamed in their ear.
There's a famous segment where contestants had to sit in a room and not react while a man in a full-body leotard did increasingly bizarre things inches from their faces. And if they laughed or flinched, they were out.
The physical comedy tradition in Japan goes back centuries. It's connected to Kyogen theater, which was the comedic counterpart to the more serious no-drama. And you can see that lineage in these shows. The commitment to physicality, the use of the body as a comedic instrument, the willingness to endure genuine discomfort for a laugh. It's all part of a tradition that's much older than television.
Western audiences sometimes see these shows and think they're just random absurdity, but there's a deep cultural context. The Batsu game format, for instance, draws on a long tradition of Japanese comedy duos, where one plays the straight man and one plays the fool. The straight man, the tsukumi, often physically chastises the fool, the boke, and that dynamic is baked into the structure of the punishment games.
The physical punishment itself, the bamboo whacking, the slapstick, is essentially man's eye comedy adapted for television. Man's eye is the Japanese equivalent of stand-up duos, and it often involves one partner hitting the other as a punchline. When you see Hamada whacking Endu with a bamboo stick in a Batsu game, you're seeing a tradition that goes back to the early 20th century, adapted and amplified for modern audiences.
Let's talk about the format differences between Japanese and Western comedy shows, because I think there's something structural going on.
The biggest difference is the role of the host and the panel. Japanese variety shows almost always feature a panel of comedians and celebrities who watch the main content and react to it. There's a small window in the corner of the screen showing their faces while the main footage plays. This is called wipe, the reaction shot in the corner, and it's so standard that Japanese audiences barely notice it, but Western audiences often find it distracting.
The panel isn't just watching passively. They're performing. Their reactions are part of the show's content. A good panelist can elevate mediocre footage just by having an entertaining reaction to it.
This is something that almost never translates to Western adaptations. Western audiences tend to find the reaction wipe format intrusive. They want to see the actual content, not someone else watching it. But in Japan, the communal viewing experience is part of the point. You're not just watching people fall into mud. You're watching famous comedians watch people fall into mud, and their laughter gives you permission to laugh.
It's a fundamentally different theory of what television comedy is. Western comedy tends to be direct. Here's the funny thing. Laugh at it. Japanese variety comedy is mediated. Here's the funny thing, and here are some funny people laughing at it, and their laughter is part of what makes it funny.
This connects to the Japanese concept of reading the air, kuki o yomu. In Japanese social contexts, people are highly attuned to the reactions of others. You look around the room to see how everyone else is responding before you respond yourself. The reaction wipe format is basically institutionalizing that instinct. The panel is reading the air for you.
Which brings us to another crossover hit, Terrace House.
Terrace House is fascinating because it's the anti-Takeshi's Castle. It's a reality show where nothing happens. Six strangers live in a beautiful house and they go to work. They develop mild crushes on each other. The drama is so understated that it barely qualifies as drama, and it became a global phenomenon on Netflix.
The panel is crucial here, too. Terrace House has a panel of comedians who watch the footage and comment on it, and their commentary is often funnier and more entertaining than the actual show. They're reading the air of the house's social dynamics and translating it for the audience.
The panel on Terrace House, particularly the comedian Yama-chan, would seize on tiny details and spin them into elaborate theories about the housemates' motivations. A glance that lasted half a second too long would become a 10-minute discussion about romantic tension, and the audience loved it because it felt like watching the show with your funniest friends.
The show's gentle pace and lack of manufactured drama was actually its selling point. In a media landscape dominated by conflict-driven reality TV, Terrace House was almost meditative. People made coffee. They went to the grocery store. They had polite disagreements about cleaning schedules. And millions of people around the world watched it obsessively.
Then there's Documental, which is the polar opposite of Terrace House. Documental is an Amazon Prime show created by Hitoshi Matsumoto, the same Matsumoto from Gaki no Tsukai, and the premise is 10 comedians are locked in a room for 6 hours. They each put up 1 million yen. The last person to laugh wins all the money. If you laugh, you're eliminated.
It's the Batsu game format, but compressed and intensified. No 24 hours, no structured segments, just 10 comedians in a room trying to make each other laugh while not laughing themselves.
It is absolutely unhinged. These are professional comedians who know each other well, and they have total creative freedom. No censors, no network standards, no restrictions. The result is some of the most boundary-pushing comedy ever filmed. Contestants will do literally anything to make their opponents crack, and I mean anything. The show comes with content warnings that are earned.
The international versions of Documental are interesting too. There's a UK version called Last One Laughing, an Australian version, a German version, an Italian version. The format translates remarkably well across cultures because the core concept is universal. Trying not to laugh is funny.
The Japanese original has a particular intensity that the international versions haven't quite matched, partly because these comedians have been working together for decades, and partly because the Japanese version has no content restrictions whatsoever. The international versions are all slightly sanitized.
Let's circle back to where we started and talk about why these shows resonate so strongly with international audiences, the so-called Japanophile world that the prompt mentions.
I think there are a few factors. One is sheer novelty. When Takeshi's Castle first hit international markets, there was nothing like it. Western game shows were people answering trivia questions or spinning wheels. The idea of 100 people storming a castle while getting knocked into water by giant foam obstacles was completely alien.
That novelty hasn't worn off because Japan keeps producing things that don't fit Western categories. The Japanese media ecosystem is large enough and self-contained enough that it develops its own genres and formats without much concern for what international audiences expect. By the time these shows get exported, they're already fully formed and deeply strange.
The second factor is the sincerity I mentioned earlier. These shows aren't ironic. They're not winking at the audience. Even the most absurd Japanese variety shows treat their premises with complete commitment. And that sincerity is refreshing in a Western media landscape that's often drowning in irony and self-awareness.
There's also something to be said for the physicality. These are shows about bodies doing things. People falling, running, climbing, enduring. It's comedy that works regardless of language. You don't need subtitles to understand why a man getting hit in the face with a giant foam ball is funny.
That physical comedy tradition connects to something primal. Slapstick is one of the oldest forms of humor. It predates language. A pratfall is funny in every culture. Japanese variety shows understand this at a bone-deep level and have refined physical comedy to an art form.
The third factor, which people don't talk about as much, is the editing. Japanese variety shows are edited with incredible precision. The reaction shots, the replays, the music cues, it's all designed to maximize comedic impact. A Takeshi's Castle elimination isn't just shown once. It's shown from three angles, in slow motion, with dramatic music, and then replayed again while the panel reacts. The editing teaches you how to watch it.
That's actually a point of criticism from some Western viewers. They find the editing manipulative. The constant replays, the reaction wipes, the on-screen text that tells you what emotion you should be feeling. It can feel heavy-handed if you're not used to it.
That's the language of the format. Every television tradition has its own grammar. American reality TV has confessional interviews and dramatic music stings. British panel shows have quick cuts and sarcastic hosts. Japanese variety has reaction wipes and text overlays and triple replays. None of these are inherently better or worse. They're just different dialects of the same medium.
Once you learn the dialect, it becomes part of the pleasure. I've watched enough Japanese variety that the reaction wipe feels completely natural to me now. When I watch Western shows that don't have it, the viewing experience almost feels lonely.
There's one more show I want to mention before we wrap up, VS Arashi. This was a game show hosted by the boy band Arashi, and the premise was that the band members would compete against guest celebrities in a series of physical games. The games were absurd. There was one called Kicking Sniper, where they had to kick a ball to knock objects off a platform, and another called Cliff Climb, where they had to scale a wall while grabbing numbered panels in sequence.
VS Arashi ran from 2008 to 2020, and it was enormously popular in Japan. The games were silly but challenging, and the chemistry between the Arashi members was the real draw. They'd been performing together since 1999, and their banter felt natural and warm.
The show had this very specific aesthetic. Bright colors, upbeat music, a studio audience that was mostly women in their 20s and 30s. It was aggressively wholesome. Nobody got humiliated. Nobody fell into mud. The competition was friendly. And it was still completely absorbing.
That's the range of Japanese game shows. You've got Takeshi's Castle on one end. Pure chaos, physical humiliation, almost no one wins. And you've got VS Arashi on the other. Friendly competition, no stakes, everyone has a good time. And in between, you've got everything from the psychological warfare of Documental, to the athletic purity of Sasuke, to the theatrical cooking of Iron Chef.
It's a spectrum of absurdity.
That spectrum exists because Japanese television never decided that game shows had to be one thing. In the West, we tend to put shows in boxes. This is a quiz show. This is a reality competition. This is a variety show. Japanese television just doesn't care about those categories. A show can be a cooking competition and a theatrical spectacle and a sports broadcast all at once. It can be a game show and a comedy show and a psychological experiment. The categories are irrelevant.
The prompt asks about shows that crossed over to the Japanophile world, and I think what defines that crossover appeal is exactly that category defiance. The shows that break out internationally are the ones that don't fit neatly into Western expectations. They're the ones that make you go, "I don't know what this is, but I can't stop watching."
The internet has been essential for this. In the pre-internet era, Takeshi's Castle reached international audiences through licensed broadcasts and dubs. But the current wave of Japanese variety fandom is driven by fan subtitling communities, streaming platforms, and social media clips. You can fall into a Gaki no Tsukai rabbit hole on YouTube at 2 in the morning and emerge 6 hours later with a deep appreciation for a comedy duo you'd never heard of before.
The international Japanophile community, and I use that term descriptively, not pejoratively, has built an entire infrastructure around making this content accessible. Fan translators subtitle hours of variety show footage for no compensation. They maintain wikis documenting every Batsu game segment. They create viewing guides for newcomers. It's a labor of love.
It's worth noting that a lot of this content isn't officially available outside Japan. The fan translation community exists because the official distribution channels don't. Netflix and Amazon have started licensing some shows, Terrace House Documental, the Takeshi's Castle reboot, but there's still a vast library of Japanese variety content that's essentially inaccessible to non-Japanese speakers without fan intervention.
Which creates this interesting dynamic where the most dedicated international fans often have a deeper knowledge of obscure Japanese variety shows than the average Japanese person. It's the same phenomenon you see with any niche international fandom. The distance from the source culture makes the engagement more intense.
That intensity can tip into something uncomfortable. There's a fine line between appreciation and fetishization, and the Japanophile community doesn't always stay on the right side of it. But I think for most international fans, the appeal is about the comedy. These shows are funny. They're weird and surprising and delightful, and they make people laugh across enormous cultural distances.
That's the ultimate test, isn't it? If a show can make someone in Manchester laugh at the same thing that made someone in Tokyo laugh, 30 years apart, across a language barrier, through a fan translation or a comedy dub, that's a genuine cultural achievement.
Takeshi Kitano, standing in his castle in 1986, probably had no idea he was creating something that would still be making people laugh 4 decades later. He was just making a weird show about people falling into water.
The best things usually start that way.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The venom of the Siberian pit viper was long believed to cause a unique cold bite sensation due to a specialized neurotoxin. But a 2014 study from the Yamal Peninsula confirmed the effect was actually a misattribution. The cold sensation comes from the venom's vasoconstrictive properties combined with subarctic ambient temperatures. Not a unique toxin at all.
The snake wasn't special. The snake was just cold.
The snake was just cold.
To wrap this up, the thing I keep coming back to is how these shows function as a kind of cultural diplomacy. They're not trying to be ambassadors, they're just being weird. And that weirdness travels further and lasts longer than any carefully crafted cultural export ever could. Nobody in the Japanese government sat down and said, "Let's make people fall into mud for international goodwill." It just happened. And now millions of people around the world have a genuine affection for Japanese comedy that they wouldn't have otherwise.
The format keeps evolving. The 2023 Takeshi's Castle reboot proved there's still an appetite. Documental is still producing new seasons. The Batsu Game specials are still annual events. This isn't a nostalgia play. It's a living tradition that keeps finding new audiences.
If you've never watched any of this stuff, the entry point is easy. Takeshi's Castle is on Prime Video. The Batsu Game compilations are all over YouTube. Fall into the rabbit hole. The mud is warm.
Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flemingtop for the fun fact and for keeping the show running. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review.
We'll be back next week with something completely different.
Probably not about people falling into mud.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.